Oh, I got a just kind of general stuff I get ready. Five procedures. We talked about the five C's. There were five procedures. Give in to God. Two, listen to God's direction. Three, check for guidance. Four, restitution. Five would be sharing. Ernie Kurtzen and Not God there, he came up with these informal settings, no religious denominations, changed life, not paid. It was all voluntary. You did this for yourself. Except when Frank set these things up and went out there, he expected all arrangements to be made, everything taken care of, and you know, you do the groundwork and I'll do the conversion. They used ideas and methods that came from earlier Christian based by anonymity. This was, very early. They changed this and got into the key person strategy Mel was talking about. But very early on, it was anonymity. He had jargon and vocabulary that was pretty catchy. As a matter of fact, some of our slogans today came from the Oxford group. First things first, let go and let God. Here's a neat one. If everybody cares enough and shares enough, everybody will have enough. World changing through life changing.
Who said that last one? Bill Clinton?
Only smoked one then.
There's enough. There's enough for everybody's need, but not for their greed. Sin is a disease. It must be attacked. Christ is the answer, and surrender is the cure. There, but for the grace of God, will you see around in a few? That was you'd see that around in the Oxford group. No pay for soul surgery. Oh, here's a great one. Give as much as you know about yourself to God. How much do you need? How much, you know, you give as much as you know about yourself to as much as you know about God. God, you understand. That's a good place to start. Faith, small as a mustard seed is enough. Win your argument, lose your man. I gave you that one.
Is there one about the eyedropper? That you can't do it from the second story to put an eyedropper from the...
Ooh, I hadn't heard that one. They're going to go off onto their own, world-changing. Sam and his boys at Calvary Church are going to leave him behind and get concentrated back into the Episcopal ministry of Calvary Church. We're really getting a little ahead of ourselves here, though, because AA is going to get started about now, and Bill Wilson's going to sense the same thing that Bookman picked up, or that Sam Shoemaker picked up on. We're going to have to separate and get our own identity here. I don't think we want to travel down the road with these boys. Thank you for what you gave us. And we're going to use it. We're going to retune it. We're going to put new vocabulary words into it. And we're going to aim it at drunks. But we can't travel your road any further. You may do us more harm. And we have our God-directed thing to do, too, you know. We did. Dick Burns got into this. What was it? 36 or 30? I told you there were no steps. No six Oxford group steps. Dick is identified. I've forgotten now. 32 or 36 Oxford group tenets, principles, all of them, every single one of them is directly, you don't have to stretch at all, directly brought by Wilson into Alcoholics Anonymous, is in your big book today in reworded terms, except one, Bible study. But all of the rest of them, in a Wilson did, he was a genius, he reformulated this into a language the drunks understood and then could communicate it to others.
You had a question back here, George.
Did he write those down for the Oxford group, or were those 32 tenets his opinion?
This is Dick's research. And I loved Ernie Kurtz. He told me, he said, I said, I don't know if it's time to write a book or not. He said, you will never have enough. Take what you got. It's time to go. I said, how do you do that? He said, well, it's kind of like holding a handful of matchsticks. You throw them up in the air and watch them come down, and you look at the table and see if there's a pattern. And if you don't see a pattern, gather them all up, throw them up in the air again and see what's come down the table. Look for the pattern and go with that. Dick Burns has spent a long, long time in primary references. He's thrown his matchsticks up in the air, and he said, look, I think these come down to about these 32 or 36 categories. And boy, you know, surrender, we would call it, well, we still, a lot of places call it surrender. We call it acceptance, you know, restitution, we call it amends, you know, confession, and we call it your fifth step, absolutes, recognize you. Sin is there, you got to root it out, and we call it the first step. Jesus will admit you're a drunk. And these are his opinions, but they go there. I hate using the word opinion, that sounds like a real soft touch. We're talking about serious academic research by a guy who knows what he's doing here, and he's just divided them into categories.
We have Tex and then Linda here.
Could you, either one of you, say something more about the idea of soul surgery?
Well, that was a term that somebody wrote a book about Frank and called him the soul surgeon. I haven't really got into that much, but that's just kind of a term that they started using, too.
Medicine works on your body. We work on your soul. We need to do not just giving medications and treating. Oh, here's one key why that came out. Not treating symptoms. Let's go for the cause. We're not talking about putting a Band-Aid on this. Let's do surgery and just remove it. Yeah.
I think it might have even been Bigby that gave him that term. I'm not sure, back in the 20s.
Yeah.
But it's just something that popped up, and they liked it in the Oxford group and used it. Linda?
I was just going to say, when you showed us that book, you had first said there were 36 principles in there.
32, 34, 36, something like that.
The way I was taught about our AA program is that our recovery at the bottom of the triangle is our 12 steps, and that's 12 spiritual principles. And the unity is 12 traditions, and that was another 12 spiritual principles. And the service, we have the 12 concepts for world service, and that they were another 12 spiritual principles, and together AA was 36 spiritual principles. So that made sense when you said there were 36 in that other book as well.
Yeah, the numerology, and Kennedy's secretary was named Lincoln, and Lincoln's secretary was named Kennedy, and I'll give you a real short quick, because we're just going to have like a general topic. You can ask Bill, when he wrote those 12 steps down in bed with his legal pad that night, you know, he said he didn't intentionally know or do it. It was just kind of came to him. But when he got done, he looked at them and said, oh, 12. Just like the apostles. Sounds good. Numerology, yeah.
You know, Bill had also said there were six ideas that they were using, they were loosely using. And I think this is where the idea that came, that they had the six steps of the Oxford group and everything. But I'd like to read them, if I may. The first one was, we admitted that we were licked, that we were powerless over alcohol. Two, we made a moral inventory of our defects or sins. Three, we confessed or shared our shortcomings with another person in confidence. Four, we made restitution to all those we had harmed by our drinking. Five, we tried to help other alcoholics with no thought of reward in money or prestige. Six, we prayed to whatever God we thought there was for power to practice these precepts. Those were what Bill says they were using.
We got to remember here, too, where did Bill Wilson get this stuff from? Ebby brought the message to him about the Oxford group and how you can change your life, and I quit drinking this way. And then Ebby brought him to Sam Shoemaker, the leader of the Oxford group in the United States. He got taught the Oxford Group principles by Sam Shoemaker, the man. Bill Wilson never did anything second class. He went first class everywhere he went. This all was coming. We've got a letter as early as January of 35. Bill Wilson hadn't been sober, what, a month or so? And Sam is saying, boy, I can't give it exactly the overall. You really did great with that drunk. Could I send you another one? Using Oxford Group principles here and everything. Bill was thoroughly steeped in the Oxford Group and its methods and procedures. It's not unusual that these steps, when he finally writes them, is just going to be soaked with Oxford Group right from the very first into the last word of life. But there weren't... In Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, Bill writes this. He said, our word-of-mouth program. See, there wasn't anything written down until he did those steps. This is the substance of what we were telling newcomers. This is the Oxford Group program aimed at drugs. Akron is still including those four absolutes today, as if there were an extra four steps, you know. We were licked. Well, you read those there. Step one, we were licked. Step four, moral inventory. Step five, confessed our shortcomings. Step eight through nine, restitution. He states that he began writing our 12. This is a statement by Bill Wilson. He began writing our 12 steps with the six steps that Mel just gave you there. He just rewrote them and expanded them, because he knew drunks would try and wiggle out if he left any little door open there. And then I renumbered these new steps. That's a key one there. Page 161, he says, then I renumbered these new steps. There leaves an implication there that there were six to begin with. There weren't. What he actually had were six. He had these six things for about a week. He went to his Tuesday night meeting at Clinton Street at his home at 182 Clinton Street, and he said, boys, I'm writing this book. It's going to be great. I'm at the point now in the title chapter how I'm going to have to start putting it down. Help me here. Let's boil down our procedures. Give me your shot. What do you think we ought to say here? Let's get the precision that we're going to need and write it down. And they gave him up with that evening, that night at the Tuesday meeting. They boil down the Oxford Group to six major hits in order of how they're done. They took all the five procedures, the five C's, all of that, put it together. He knew that he was going to have to start writing this chapter, so he asked them to boil down their methods, and from this discussion, he came home with six ideas. He sat in bed and said, okay, let's write them down. By the time he got done, there were 12 of them. And that's where our 12 steps come from. There weren't any six Oxford Group steps.
Well, we got three more minutes. So somebody... yes, Don.
Is it true he wrote that in 35 minutes?
He said he didn't put a clock on it, but Bill talked about it several times, and he usually used the term about a half an hour. About a half an hour. And then they talked about him, and they went through the groups, and they reworked him, and they put in as we understood him, and they took out the steps on your knees. They took that out, and actually, the controversy over all of those steps and everything, and too much God, not enough, all of that started that very night. Those steps weren't 24 hours old. A buddy came over to visit him and brought his new pigeon, and Bill said, "Oh, here, look, I got these steps here. Look at them. See what you guys think about this. We're going to put it in a book, will you?" And no, too much God, I don't like that. We'll tell you, it didn't get a chance to get cold before the controversy over. But, yeah.
We had Peter, and then we had Tex and Barbara.
I don't know if this is off the track, but you said you met Clarence Snyder, and I read an article in the newspaper of an interview of him in Florida. Was he serious about considering himself the true founder of AA? I mean, was he that egotistical and overblown?
Well, it came out that way.
He was very careful to always say, I started the first meeting to be called Alcoholics Anonymous after the title of our new book. And that's true. And he was very proud of this was the first time that alcoholics only, not family members and you all come kind of thing, real AA, a closed AA meet. And he always said it, but again, back to the newspaper and the print media. They don't understand this kind of stuff. They don't know anything about it. and they only got so much space. And so when either reporter come in and interview you, Clarence, and you explain this, maybe not as knowing what's going on, maybe not real clear, you know, but you are going to make a shot at saying it. When I print it in the newspaper tomorrow morning, Clarence Snyder, founder of AA.
Well, my oldest son,
the rubber balloon, truth, and we stretch it, you know.
I wondered about that.
My oldest son helped transcribe some of these tapes of these interviews, you know, and he picked up on, he was going to college then, and he did this for me, and he picked up on Clarence right away just listening to the tapes, and he called Clarence the first franchisee, like with McDonald's. See, somebody else had the prop, the idea that Clarence became the first franchisee. And I thought that was pretty good.
You've got to listen to these interviews that Mel. Yeah. Mel is a professional. He interviewed Clarence. Clarence was going around the bush about the founder of the first real meeting of this and that and the other and going on, making implications, but not stating that he was the founder of A. Not going that far, you know. I was getting real. People looking at this made comments. Ebby, first of all, see, he got a little jealous because Bill went out to Akron, and he and Bill were trying to stay sober there in New York, and now all of a sudden here comes his buddy Bill back with this new Dr. Bob guy, and where is he coming from, who's this, and I'm getting cut out of the picture, and they've got this great relationship going, talking about Dr. Bob all the time, all the time, all the time. Some other interesting comments come back. A lot of folks come in that Ebby had some resentments. It was Bill stayed sober and he couldn't, you know. He would have been the founder. Bill should have included him in as a founder. Some folks even went so far as to suggest, I've got nothing on Ebby for sure, but suggesting that Ebby thought he ought to get some money off the big book. He couldn't stay sober in New York because he was always around the Bill Wilson influence. Ebby was a tragic figure, a great guy. But once he drank, you know, he lost his slot, kind of a thing.
Bill, you know, and there was once he drank, then that was it, and it was over, and he could never get that position, the number one slot again. And the need to kind of live off of Bill always had money available for Ebby and help him out and stuff. Ebby is a very, very tragic story, very tragic story.
Well, we're at the point for a break again. Could we break and come back at 3:00?
Yeah.
How the Oxford Group ideas got from the Oxford Group to Roland Hazard, and how Carl Jung threw something in there and then got it down to Ebby Thatcher, and then Ebby Thatcher calls on Bill. And I talked a little bit about Ebby. And now we're going to go into the Oxford Group out to Akron, Ohio for you, and we've got it in New York, and we're going to talk about Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith. And George is going to take the part of Dr. Bob, and I'm going to be Bill Wilson. So George, just imagine a fellow that's much taller than George. And,
better looking.
Kind of rather scholarly looking. some other qualities.
Opinion!
But George is going to talk about Dr. Bob Smith and what his life was like.
And I'm going to read off of some notes here. I hope that... I took a lot of speech training when I was in college. I learned, it's pretty well established, one-third of the people, when you walk in that door, one-third of the people in that audience are with you, and I mean right now, and you can't do anything, they're going to love you forever. It's autumn. It's something about the way you walk or whatever. And I'm not concerned about you guys out there. It's the one-third, because I got you. I'm going to keep you, so to hell with you. Now, one-third are going to be against you. They just don't like the way you shuffled in or your hair's mussed or something, and you're never going to get them, so forget about them. I don't care about you either. But there's a third of you out there that I can sway. You're undecided. You're going to judge as we go along here. And you, I'm very concerned on. I have taken a lot of time and research and patience and practice. I want to do this just right because I want to win every one of you that I possibly can. I'm going to read off the notes. I'm not an expert on Dr. Bob. I'm also under the gun here. I'm sitting next to the guy who's going to do Bill Wilson, who spent 45 years studying him. You know, he doesn't need any notes. I hope it's not offensive, but two-thirds of you doesn't matter anyway. I'm explaining to the third I'm trying to win. Please excuse me for these reading of the notes here. You know, maybe 45 years from now, I could be an expert on Dr. Bob, too. But then again, I don't know. I'd wind up to be a cranky old codger that nobody likes, so.
I happen to know that I have a lot of friends in AA because every Mother's Day I get a lot of cards.
Now here, oh good, yeah, this we're really got them all primed up for a nice, serious, scholarly discussion of Dr. Bob, right? AA by its very nature is sharing. It's not a loner's endeavor. There couldn't have been just one founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Bill and Bob were, they were well educated. They were both six-footers, both from Vermont. They were both characters. They had so much character about them. They both had presence. Everybody always, when they walked into the room, everybody froze onto them. They had command of the situation. They had a sense of presence about them, both of them, overpowering people. However, without Alcoholics Anonymous, they just simply would have been two very short stories with tragic endings. That's the commonality that is the biggie between them. So here we are today on the eve of the 21st century, but for right now I'm going to try and take you back into the 19th century, okay? I'm a youngster. I'm going to grow up in Vermont in the class of 98. Now, the freshmen, it's the freshmen who would be entering high school today are in the class of 98. However, I'm in the class of 1898, all right? 100 years ago. I was born August 8th, 1879 in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. About 7,000 people. I don't think you'd go over 8,000 people today. That's the way those little New England towns are up there. They're not interested in growing, thank you very much. If you haven't lived here for seven generations, you're an outsider. Born at the corner of Central and Summer Streets, right there in the front bedroom. That's the way things were done in those days. Now, this is 16 years before Bill Wilson was born, by the way. He was born 100 miles southwest of me, a little place called East Dorset. St. Johnsbury was always home to me. As a matter of fact, I never really left Vermont. Not only did my accent never leave, I never really left. I went back every year. There was a trip back home to the old stomping grounds. My dad was a judge. Walter Perrin Smith was his name. He was a director of the Merchants National Bank. He was a president of the Passumpsic Savings Bank. That's a river that goes through St. Johnsbury there. He taught Sunday school for 40 years. He was superintendent of the public schools. He was, of course, an attorney. He became state's attorney, and a matter of fact, later then a judge in the Vermont Probate Court, and was eventually elected a member of the state legislature of Vermont. Prominent man. He tried repeatedly to save me from my fate. He was pulling me out of my fat out of the fire. He would come all the way from Vermont to wherever I was in trouble when I was really having serious problems and give me his best help. He wasn't able to. it wasn't so much that he was ashamed or afraid of the family name and the reputation. He didn't want his son heading where he saw me going. It hurt him that he couldn't do anything to help me. One of the unfortunates of my life is that he did not live to see me sober up. He died in 1918, as a matter of fact, and that's just when I was starting the heaviest part of my drinking career. My mother was a very stern, tight-lipped, no-nonsense kind of lady. She demanded I was in bed by 5 o'clock. Of course, I later redressed and slipped out, and I wasn't going to put up with that, but I wouldn't let her catch me either. Matter of fact, I'm going to later marry a lady, Annie. And she always blamed my mom for my alcoholism until she fully understood this disease concept thing. She, once I got away from home and broke away from mom, all hell broke loose, and she thought maybe mom kept too tight a rein on me. Mom believed that the way to success and salvation was through a very strict parental supervision and a regular spiritual devotional program. She dragged me down to the St. Johnsbury North Congregational Church 5 times a week. On Sunday, I went 3 times. I went to the regular church service, then there was Sunday school, and in the evening, there were services. On Monday, we turned right back around and went to Christian Endeavor, and on Wednesday, we went down for prayer meeting night. Once I broke away from Mom, for the next 40 years, I'd never again, under very exceptional circumstances, ever darken the door of a church again. I was done with that. 2 heavy adults. Mom did live to see me sober. I was always happy about that. She was a completely different woman than Ann's mother. I can remember Annie's mother. She would come over there when we were living on Ardmore Street, married years later. Ann's mother would come over there, and she'd spend a week. It was a week of cooking and cleaning and straightening up, and there was visiting, but there was also, how's everything doing? Can I chip in, put in hand? My mother visited us once there on Ardmore Street, and well, let's see. Both the kids had the flu. Ann and I were down, and we were sick. Everybody was just sick and down. And my mom walked in there and saw all that, looked around, and put her bag down, found a bed, crawled in at herself. My mother was no nonsense. She had her way of thinking, she had her way of acting, and she didn't change. Not till the day she died. I have a sister, much, much older sister, Amanda Northrup is her. She went on, she became a history professor down at Hunter College down in New York City. She'd come home, and my folks had a cottage, a summer cabin cottage out on Lake Champlain. And during the summer, I remember Amanda and I, and we'd play together out there and did some horseback riding and stuff, and we knew each other, but she was so much older than I, and always away from me. I basically grew up as an only child. Spoiled brat, if you want to be honest about the thing. We became friends very close later on in life, called a lot and wrote letters and visited and stuff like that. I remember as a kid, I used to go out and hike in the hills, and I fished in the lakes. I loved swimming. As a matter of fact, I was a very strong. One time I saved a girl who was drowning. And that encouraged me even more. I became an expert. Some would even call me a world-class swimmer. I made sure my kids, they knew how to swim right from the very beginning. I understood the importance of that. Hunted. I loved that. Some buddies and I went up to Canada one time. It was a 3-week survival expedition. They didn't have freeze-dried food and backpacking and all of that sort of stuff. This wasn't a recreational activity. If you're going out in the woods, it was for hunting and fishing, and you lived off the land. We were out there 3 weeks, and boy, we lived off of blueberries and hard biscuits, and we caught some eels, and that was about it. It was a tough trip. We had our guns with it. We saw a groundhog one day, stuck his head up out of his woodchuck, you might call it. And we all got our guns out, and we blasted away, blasted away, blasted away, and we ran out of ammunition, and he just turned around and went back in his hole, and we were so disappointed because we were hungry. My dad would tell that story, and my dad would always he'd always sit back, and when I finally finished up, he'd say, well, he just went back in his hole because he got tired of the noise. He didn't think he was in trouble. One trip I remember we spotted a bear, and I don't know what happened or why. The bear was startled him, I guess. He turned around and started going back at it. So we started chasing him, you know, hollering and yelling and cussing at him. We were big and brave. But I do also recall that I didn't chase him maybe as hard as I really could have. I didn't really want to chase that bear to catch him. I fell in love with the woods. I always liked it. Matter of fact, later on when my kids were growing up, every Sunday, we'll put them in the car and we'll take off and we'll go for the Sunday drive. We'll go out in the country and I'll find some old dirty, dusty road somewhere and don't care where it leads, and we'll go off and we'll find where the road will end, and we'll get out of the car and we'll start talking and hiking. And I wanted my children to be acquainted with. Today, I would join your green movement. I'd be an environmentalist right out on the front lines. I went to elementary school. That was grades, we call it, that was 1 through 8. You break them into junior high. And it was convenient. It was 2 blocks from my home down there on Summer Street. I had a lot of friends. Everybody liked me. I had an irreverent opinion of authority from the very beginning. And that made me pretty popular with a lot of the people out there. I like being popular. A little later on, moved into my early teenage years. I worked out on the farms around that area to get some spending money, you know, baling hay. I don't know if any of you have ever baled hay, but that's hot. That is work. A lot of heads going up. We're in farming country here. I was about 9, and I noticed this jug of hard cider. I knew what that was. Head's going up, yeah, hard cider. That'll make your eyeballs cross. That's one of those farm hands that had stashed it over there before in the building, and I got into it, and I drank it. Years later, I was telling a college friend later, I liked it from the very beginning. I liked the taste of it. I could kind of take it or leave it. Matter of fact, I'm not going to take another drink for another 10 years. But I had a real early taste of it. I knew what it was. It would become much closer acquainted with me later on. I worked as a bellhop at one time at one of those local resorts up there, one of those summer resorts up there. I went to high school in St. Johnsbury Academy. That's a private school. Pretty well known, pretty strict. Its most famous alumni was the 30th President of the United States, Calvin Coolidge. I was kind of like all of the people that come from that Vermont area there, Connecticut Yankee, tight-lipped, didn't say much. They always said of me that I didn't really want to talk. We'd go out for coffee after AA meetings and stuff like that. I didn't say much, but I knew the power of not saying much. When I did speak up, everybody listened, and I had something to say, and it was short, it was sweet to the point. Whether you got it or not was not my business. I like Calvin Coolidge's remark where he said for him, they wanted him to run for a second term and everything, and he wasn't going to have any part of it. And they put a lot of pressure on him. And he very simply said, if nominated, I won't run. If elected, I won't serve. That was a Dr. Bob style that I became very famous for that. And I did. I'll have to admit to it. I played to it. I knew how much power it had. Now, my buddy here, Bill, later on, he thinks quick. He's right off the bat. He's going to give you 6 answers and 5 reasons why, and I always admire how fast his brain moves. I'm slower. I might not give you your answer till tomorrow, but it will be a considered answer. He egged me on when I was moving too slow. I'm going to rein him in when he's moving too fast. I didn't do any drinking back in my high school years. I was very popular there, too. Again, all the kids liked me. Vermont back in those days had state liquor agency stores, and you had it wasn't packaged liquor stores. They were very strict control of the liquor. You had a prescription from a doctor for medicinal reasons, kind of a thing. Beer was kind of easy to come by, though. I mean, that was for hard liquor. Beer you could find it, but you had to go looking for it. Some of the folks there bootlegged in whiskey. Some of the richer folks would keep a stash there. They'd know somebody or go down to New York City and Boston and places like that, and they'd bring it. But they were looked down upon. The folks in the town that knew this was going on, they were considered to be morally bad people. There was a very, very heavy anti-booze feeling there in Vermont in those days. About my senior year in high school, I met Ann Robinson Ripley. She was from Chicago, Oak Park. Chicago, Illinois, where she was from. They're pretty well-to-do. Her dad was an attorney for the Santa Fe Railroad. There was an uncle of some kind, some related uncle, of Clarence T. Ripley. He was president of the Santa Fe Railroad, which might have been how her dad got up to be in the job. He had a very high administrative position there. They were a very nice house. You take a look at that house, you got like three stories in there. There they had some money. I was impressed. She had three brothers. All three of them wound up in Who's Who. It was a class outfit. We met when there was a senior dance there, I remember, and she was in college at the time. She studied to be a teacher at Wellesley College down in Boston, and they would come up. It was a little shuttle up there, and they'd come up, and she was visiting a friend there, and the St. Johnsbury High School senior dance was going on. She popped in, and I was attracted to her immediately, and we became very good friends almost from the very beginning. Graduated in 1898, and I was 19 years old. I went to Dartmouth College after that. It was an Ivy League college even back in the day, but it had a pretty bad reputation. It was a drinking man's school. I enjoyed Dartmouth. It was about 60 miles south of where I was at Hanover in New Hampshire, and I joined a drinking for Kappa 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 drinking fraternity. Those boys knew how to put it down. I became quite proficient in billiards, cards. I liked poker, gin rummy. Later on, they're going to call. I have been noted to be called a world-class auction bridge player, and I was. I was good, and Ann was pretty good too. Between the pair of us, we had a lot of fun. I got into horseshoes. Don't know how that happened. I just kind of liked it. In all of these things, I played for two reasons. The first reason was for money, and the second reason was to win. It wasn't any fun unless it was for both money and to win. I was dead serious. These were not recreational activities, and I became very good at all of them. I remember one time, well, later on in life, back in the up into the 1940s, there's a group got started up in Minnesota, the Nicolette Group, and they would sponsor this fishing, annual fishing trip up there to Minnesota, and we'd go up and they'd rent some cabins and we'd have a little fun. And there's a famous picture of me during one of the, holding up this big stringer of fish and stuff, and I'll have to admit to you, I didn't leave them cabins. The card games were in this cabin, and the fishermen were over there in that cabin, and I was in the card game cabin. Somebody probably caught the, I don't remember a lot of it, but I seriously doubt if I actually caught those fish. Ernie is going to, he's going to marry my daughter, and he's AA number four. A lot of folks, his story's in the big book. He was on this trip, and he was up there. I have to say, I never really did like Ernie. He married my daughter. He married Sue, and I was against it. I advised him against it and everything. I mean, how would you feel having to be walking down the aisle at this wedding here, giving away your daughter to a man who you'd taken his fifth step? I didn't really approve of her. Ernie came along on this fishing trip, and he started needling me. Come on, you got to get out of here. Get out in the air. Let's move right. You know? And so I finally took care of old Ernie. Ernie popped up, and he said, "Let's go. There's a horseshoe pit out here. Come on, at least come out and play some horseshoes or something, will you?" And that's when I said, "Okay." And we played for a quarter, and I beat him 2 out of 3, and he never quit talking. He said, "Where? I'm a damn good horseshoe player. Where did you, have you never told me? How'd you learn how to play horseshoe?" And I just smiled and walked back into the cabin and got back down to the poker game. I took care of Ernie. He never knew what hit him. I remember a drinking story I might tell you about when I was at Dartmouth there. We were out, don't really know why, we were down by the railroad yards, and there was an open door in one of those boxcars, and there was a hobos were pretty. There were a lot of hobos back in those days, and he was hanging his feet out there. And he said, "Hey, you guys, there's a little sandwich. Give me something to eat. Can you go to town?" And we went in, got him some sandwiches, came back, and we got to talk. I got real intrigued about riding the rods and being a hobo, and that sounded kind of adventurous. We hopped a freight train, me and my buddy. It wound up clear down into the state capital down there, Montpelier, and We got off early in the morning and dusted ourselves, got all the straw out of our hair and everything, wandered around. We found drank a couple of beers for breakfast, and there was a big deal going on in the state capitol. Admiral Dewey was just retired, the famous hero of the Battle of Manila Bay, was returning back to his United States, a big tour, and the governor was having a stand, a reviewing stand, a big parade and all that. So we thought we'd go down there and see this Admiral Dewey thing. We ran across another fellow while we was drinking beer that morning. He was from Dartmouth. And we got talking about Dartmouth, this, that, and the other. He said, well, come on down. You can come down and see the Admiral Dewey parade with me. We'll sit right up front. I asked him why, and he said, because my father is the governor. And so here we were, right off of the, hopped off of the freight in all rumpled clothes, three quarters drunk, and winding up there sitting with the governor watching the parade. I like to drink. I had a lot of fun drinking. I'm not going to wiggle out of it any other way. I enjoy it. I like chug-a-lug. I had this thing called a patent throat. I learned where you can take your Adam's apple and just kind of push it all the way back, and your throat is nothing but an empty hollow tube all the way down. And I'd get in contests. Remember, I always played to win and always played for money. Okay, and they were trying to drink it as fast as they could, and I just turned her upside down and it went straight down. They never knew how that worked, and I walked away with the pot every time. And I still, all my life, I'd amaze people. I'd just take a couple of pills and some water, and if she didn't be gone, they'd say, you didn't even swallow. I used that trick for a long time. I set about my drinking with my usual characteristics of dedication, perseverance, and a great deal of natural ability right from the very beginning. Drinking was no problem. It was fun. I could always outdrink anybody else. Had a hollow leg, no hangovers whatsoever. And, of course, today I know that these are signs of alcoholism. I thought I was blessed and found out that I was cursed. 1902, I graduated. I was 24 years old, and I wanted to become a doctor. My mother said, no way. She got her way, and I became a traveling salesman. I went to work for the Fairbanks Morse Company. I did this for 2 years. I sold Toledo, by the way, Mel, is not the only place in the world that sells scales. Fairbanks Morse is based out of St. Johnsbury, Vermont. My dad, the lawyer, was a lawyer for Fairbanks Morse Company. It wasn't accidental that I got a nice paying traveling salesman's job selling industrial scales and stuff with Fairbanks Morse. I didn't really like that. Tried it for a couple of years. I went on another traveling salesman kind of job for a few months. I can't even remember the name of the company. I didn't like that very much. I sold railway supplies and heavy hardware, gas engines and all that kind of stuff. Railroad equipment things. If I had to remember, I guess probably Ann's family had a little something to do with me getting that job. That wasn't accidental either. I wound up working finally in 1905, about 3 years of this stuff. I wound up working in Fellini's department store down in Boston. I didn't particularly want to work at a department store, but you see, Ann was in Boston going to college there at the time, so that was convenient. We hung around, got to know each other a little better there. One thing I do want to mention, in this whole 3 years of being a salesman, I never lost but a half a day's work. Another sign, I believe, of alcoholism. The overachiever who has to prove that he does not have a problem. And that was me. Finally talked Mom into letting me be a doctor. She wasn't happy, but I did. Went to the University of Michigan, started there in 1905, was 26 years old. And one of the very first, most important things you had to do there was to join a fraternity. I picked another drinking fraternity, of course. And this is when I started my binge drinking. I'd go out 2, 3, 4 days. I started missing classes. I got the shakes. I got the jitters. This is going to be the worst physical symptom. I just physically, matter of fact, years later, I'm going to be a doctor in downtown Akron at the Second National Bank building. They have a lunch counter down there, and I'd come in the morning and I'd drink bromel seltzers and tomato juice and take aspirin, and I'd just be sitting there. A lady who would, she worked there at the bank building too, she'd see me come down there and she'd see me over. She actually asked the guy there if I had palsy. she was showing pity on me. You know, palsy is, Katharine Hepburn has it, the shaking, all constantly shaking. That's how bad I was. Imagine that, a surgeon. Yeah. These shakes, these jitters, start right here now when I'm at Dartmouth, or at University of Michigan. They got so bad and I got so screwed up. Everything was, I dropped out by 1907. I said, this isn't going to work. I'm going to flunk out. So I packed my grip and headed south. I had a buddy who had a farm, and I spent about a month down there drying out. That's what that was, getting defogged. And when I finally came to, I said, uh-oh, I might have screwed up. Let's reconsider this. Let's go back. They didn't like it. We had some pretty long arguments, but they did finally allow me to take my exams, which I passed. I had no problem. I had bookwork. I was never any problem with that. And they were glad I passed, and they gave me the credits. But they finally came to the decision that, if at all possible, they were just going to have to struggle on without me. They thought they might be able to make it without me. And I had to transfer. Tough to transfer credits in the middle of the year, but I did. I wound up going to Chicago to Rush Medical College. I got in there, and of course I did the very first thing that you have to do. The most important thing is I had joined a fraternity, a drinking fraternity. This is when I started on hard liquor. Been beer pretty much all up until now. This is one of those times I finally got so bad, my fraternity brothers, they called Dad and said, he's a mess. Dad came all the way down from Vermont, tried to help me out, tried to straighten me. He did that so many times for me. I promised everything, but it just got so much worse. Matter of fact, came time around for five. Back in those days, they had these little blue books they'd pass out for your final exams. You had all your tests and answers and everything were written down in these books, and I turned in three of them completely blank. It wasn't because I didn't know the stuff. My hands were shaking so bad, I couldn't even write. Physical thing is really kicking in on me. So the dean said he was going to kick me out of there. I said, wait a minute, this is two in a row. Can't, you know, we'll work a deal here. And so the dean gave me a deal. He said, you go back and repeat your last half year. Two, pass all of your classes. And three, remain absolutely, completely dry, not one drop. I'll let you sneak through. So I did. Completed all three. Matter of fact, from there I went on and got an internship in, there's a hospital down in Akron, Ohio. They had just gotten massive amounts of money. They were buying new equipment, all this newfangled stuff and x-ray things. And it was the hottest thing going on in the country. They were spending major money. It was going to be a big place. It was a very coveted internship, and I applied for it, and I got it there, and they worked my fanny off from day into day. There were times when I just even couldn't get out of that hospital. And for that two-year period, there was just no drinking. So I went 2.5 years completely so. I know an alcoholic can do that on willpower. It is entirely possible. So I graduated out of Rush there in 1910, and I took this internship down there in Akron. Actually, my job there as an intern, what I did, I ran the pharmacy. And when that was all over, they were so impressed by me, they offered me a job on staff there, and I went ahead and passed my boards and became a practicing MD in the state of Ohio and on staff at Akron City Hospital. This is 1912. I was 33 years old, and for the next 36 years, I would remain a physician in Akron, Ohio. I'll finally retire. I'll be 69, and I'll retire. I didn't really retire. I got cancer and had to shut her down. All through World War I and World War II, so you see, I didn't see any military service or anything. Doctors, of course, were exempted from that in both wars. Got down there in that Second National Bank building I told you about. It's kind of a strange building. They called it the first Second National Bank building, and because there was a second one later, then it became the Second National Bank building. Then they called it the Centran Building. Today they call it the Society Bank Building. It's all the same place if you're out there looking for it. And you'll hear where my offices were, and you think I was all over the place, you know. While I was in the building, I was in three different rooms. I started off in room 400. that was a little expensive. A cheaper room, 928, opened up shortly thereafter. I moved there, so you'll see some of my letters. I got that room number. And then I moved to room 810. This would be around the time AA started, about 1935. So when you start looking through what is left over of me and my correspondence, it looked like that I was all over the place, and I never left the building, okay? I got on staff at Akron City Hospital, like I said. Also got visiting privileges at a lot of the different hospitals that were around in that same local area there. And also did the rounds of private sanitariums in the area. Unfortunately, this was not as a practicing physician. I was a patient. My drinking got so bad that I had to check in to dry out at least a dozen times. Bill Wilson, he thinks he's a hotshot going through town's hospital three times. He's a piker up anyways compared to what I had to. And being a doctor, I had to be very careful about that, see. Actually, things were going pretty good for me all over. My practice was making a ton of money. This is 1912. A very demanding internship has just been finished. I got a medical practice. I haven't been drinking for 2.5 years. So, let's have a drink. Within a year, things had pretty well gone to hell in a handbasket. By 1913, 1914, somewhere in there, things got pretty, pretty rough. I was in and out of those sanitary. This is just kind of a dry out for a few days, a jitter joint kind of a thing, at least a dozen times, maybe more. By 1914, I had my first real hospitalization. I was physically so well, they had to put me in a real hospital, and I was in very, very bad shape medically by 1914. They called my dad again. He had a buddy who was a doctor in Vermont, and he sent him out. And he thought maybe this doctor could work me over, and he did. He told me a lot of things, scared me very bad. I went back home to St. Johnsbury with him and stayed there with my daddy. He convinced me to come home for a rest. I was there for three months. Bill's got a line that he's going to use in the big book later on. He says, I stepped from the hospital a broken man, you know. That's obviously when he hit his bottom. I hit my bottom now. This is when I know it's overtaken me, and I better do something about it. So I'm going to buckle up. I'm going to use my willpower. I'm going to go back down to Akron, start to get back in there in the harness again, and I'm going to quit drinking again for 3 years successfully. See, I know this can be done because it's happened to me now twice. How are we doing on time? Where are we going on time?
About 15 minutes.
Let's get married. I'm going to get married to Annie, or Ann, either way, Ann Robinson Ripley. We got married in January 1915. I was 35 years old. I was not drinking. And this is after, of course, remember I met her back in high school. This is after a whirlwind courtship of 17 years. My son Smitty today will tell you, he says, my dad, when it came to women, my dad did not make any instantaneous decisions. He knew what he was dealing with, and he was very cautious. I bought her a home, 855 Ardmore Street at Everett in Akron there. It was a brand new home, 1915, brand new. It cost $4,000. That was a pretty good chunk of change back in those days, though. And we lived there the rest of our married life. Never moved out, never went anywhere else. It's a nice, comfy little place, and we called it home. I remember I bought her a new car. My practice was doing good. Bought her a new car, a Cadillac, as I remember. She wasn't very mechanical. And, y'all, all the cars back in those days are stick shift, right? And she wanted to learn how to drive, so I tried to teach her. But she would run off the roads and onto the curbs and everywhere. She could curl those old shifts would come in there. She never learned what a clutch. She drove it into the neighbors had a great big wood pile out, and she crashed right into it. We finally stored that car. Went over to a neighbor and gave him a few bucks and put him in his garage. And, she just wasn't very mechanical at all. But then, of course, she'd tell you that I wasn't very mechanical either. I remember the time she wanted me to take the wallpaper. We were going to change the wallpaper in the living room. We'd put in new carpeting and everything, and now she wanted to change the wallpaper. And So I went outside, I got the garden hose, and opened up the window and run the garden hose in through the window. And I was spraying the wall there and everything. And she came out about had a heart attack. And that was like, but there's a good side to that. She never asked me to do anything around the house anymore, too. So. What I put her through till I finally quit drinking, you know, we alcoholics have a gift of picking out the world's finest women, and why ever that they should be subjected to the tortures that we put them through, I cannot understand. She was a very wonderful woman. Well, my medical practice is going fine. I got time, I got money. We've got a summer cottage out there. There's a big lake, Akron. It's called Akron West Reservoir. We've got a summer cottage out there. Take the kids out there all the time, do swimming. I got this this 27 Cadillac. It's not being driven right now, but, and I got a second car for me. Things are going. We even had some hired help there for a while. We had a maid in for a while. I mean, she wasn't like full time or anything like that, but Annie had help. We had a laundress, a black lady, come in there once a week. She'd pick up all the clothes, do all the washing, all the ironing, get it all done in a day. She had a sister, a little sister. I remember we went out to the cabin one time there. Sue went out, took her out, and they were playmates. And they went down to the dock there, and Sue got called back up to the house. Annie called her back up to the house, and Sue walked up the little hill there and back up to the house. And when she turned around and looked around, her little playmate was gone, just gone. She drowned. Just, and nobody knows why or how, just she must have slipped off the dock or something. They had to dive down to get, the body just sank there. So she must have inhaled a lot of water. And that was tragic. That was very, very tragic. It wasn't anyone's fault. Nobody knows exactly how it happened, but I can't remember we ever went back to the cabin after that. I know Sue didn't. It was, I made sure my kids learned how to swim. That was very, very important. Let's talk about those kids. My boy is Robert Ripley Smith. They call him Smitty. Nobody really called me Smitty much. Now, I'm going to call Bill later on. I'm going to call him Willie, and he's going to call me Smithy. But when you hear Smitty, that's my boy. He's not a junior either, by the way. He's born in June of 1918. He's kind of proud of that boy. He went on to become a pilot. In World War II, flied bombers, liberators. He'll tell you a really neat story. They went him to send him through pilot's training school. This is a one-man airplane. They gave him 2 weeks of... the war is on. We're in North Africa. We got to get troops over there. I mean, now. They gave him 2 weeks of navigational school. Okay, in World War II. He said there's a little bitty island as you fly clear across the Atlantic Ocean on your way to North Africa that you have to stop and refuel on. You got just enough gas to get there. The way he puts it, he says, it's real important that you find that island. With 2 weeks of navigational training, they put him in this Liberator. He found that island. My boy was a hell of a pilot, by the way. He married Betty Anderson in 1944. They got two sons and one son and two daughters. When he was born, I was age 40. We were living there at Ardmore. We'd been there for 3 years. I was sober. I was practicing medicine very successfully. Had been for 6 years. I had a son. Everything was going great. So... let's have a drink. Life was treating me right now. Prohibition was at the end. The booze, beer was beginning to come back by then. No, I don't mean it was over. I mean it was just starting. There were a couple of things that came upon the American scene that I hadn't really prepared for. One was the bootlegger. You see, I kind of figured, well, okay, prohibition is the... I'm going to have some drinks, and then it'll be all gone, and they're not going to hurt me. But the bootlegger kind of screwed up my plans there because he made it very easy to get booze. Also, the government decided that doctors would be allowed unlimited prescriptions for alcohol for medicinal purposes. You know, if you write a prescription as an MD for something that is not really required medically, that could be considered illegal. That's how important alcohol became to me. They didn't have those fancy tracing systems they got today. I could write whatever I wanted whenever I felt like it. I drank hard for 17 years. June 10th, 1935, I finally quit, but I still had that obsession. Could stiff belt a scotch. 6-7 years that lasted before it finally ever went away. Some folks, I know it happens right away. But for you folks that it doesn't happen to right away, I want to let you know, I went through that too. Now Bill, he's going to quit. About the same. You know, it's interesting. He also had pretty hard drinking for 17 years. But there's a difference. When he quit drinking, he was 39 years old. When I quit drinking, I was 56. But let me tell you some more about the, yeah, the pictures are really, and there's some of the kids there. Let me show you about the, and there's, hold them up maybe a little higher, whatever, yeah. Those are, now there's Sue, Suzanne Smith. After we had Smitty, Ann had a miscarriage, and that prevented her from having any more kids, and we wanted more. But when we decided to adopt, we decided we wanted a girl. She was born Winona Mary, February 1918. Her mother couldn't keep her, and so she gave her to her mother and her grandmother, took her down to the Summit County orphanage there, the children's home. She's a pistol. Was and is. She's a pistol. She caught her finger in the toilet door, chopped it clean off, as a matter of fact. She says she remembers I was probably the doctor that came and treated her. We adopted her. She's 3 years old. This is the summer of 1923. She'll tell this story on me. We need one of those liar cards again, don't we? She says that she was real sure that she didn't, that we didn't want to raise Smitty as an only child and spoil him. So they adopted me and spoiled us both. I married this Ernie Galbraith guy, AA number 4. I know Bill introduced him a lot whenever he was around at conferences and stuff, and he says, here's Ernie, he's AA number 4 and all that. But I got to tell you the real truth. I was married to him. I know what was going on. He was drinking on and off, and he was a pretty rough character. My dad warned me against him, but I didn't pay much attention to my dad. Matter of fact, we got in a big fight about it, and I left home. I wouldn't put up with that. I went out and that's Ernie. That's Ernie right there. The seventh month slip was his story. They took it out of the book when the second edition came along. Matter of fact, Ann and I did not attend that Sue's wedding. We didn't go. See, he'd been previously divorced. He was 31 years older than Sue. He was running, he was drinking and ran around. In 65, they finally got a divorce. There's a couple of children, Mickey and Bonna Lee. Mickey's got two boys and a girl. Those would be my great-grandkids. Bonna Lee and her girl, Sandy, there was a very tragic death there. They're gone. And then Sue went out and married this guy, Ray Windows. Now, she'd known Ray ever since they were kids, about age 12, but I guess nobody was good enough for Sue. I didn't like Ray Windows either. His dad was a janitor, not exactly my class of folks. His dad was an alcoholic, not exactly my class of folks. he was a lazy, shuffly kind of not going. I just never was impressed by him. Sue says if I'd lived a little bit longer and finally got to know him, I would have liked him. But that didn't happen. I wasn't allowed to live quite that long. Where are we getting on the time-wise? 20 till?
Well, that this one is the one we're going.
Well, what's the old line? You can't, the brain can't absorb what the butt can't handle.
Yes, the butt and the kidneys both. Shall we break now again and be back at 4 and wind up on Dr. Bob, and then maybe we can take on Bill Wilson.
We're back. I'm back. Is the third I'm playing to still with me there? Remember, I don't care about the other two. Yeah, we got them. Okay, here we go. Things are going so good for me, I'm going to pick this back up again. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go up to Mayo Clinic. I'm going to study under the Mayo brothers. I'm going to become a surgeon, and I'm going to study in proctology. I'm going to specialize. This is an era when doctors don't specialize. And the few that are specializing are not specializing in proctology, right? Oh, yeah, I got to show you. This is a pretty rare book. Because there just weren't that many printed at the time. The book is The Handbook of Diseases of the Rectum. I'm glad the guy saw this and collected, because specializing in proctology in those days was there weren't that many textbooks running around. If you want an opinion, that's probably one of my textbooks. No reason to think not. It was a pretty gutsy move. Also, another something's going to happen to me, and I'm not really prepared for you. See, the Depression's going to hit, and here I am going to be stranded out there specializing in a pretty rare field. That demands that I'm going to make my money off of references only, and my drinking is going to get around. Matter of fact, there's an old saying in Akron about this time. They started saying, if you had to go to Dr. Bob Smith, you really did bet your ass. Also became what's called first call surgeon on the B&O Railroad. In case there was a wreck anywhere in that general area and they needed a surgeon, I'd get called out first, see? And didn't make a lot of money off that, but I did get a free pass for me and Annie on the railroad. We've just traveled around everywhere, and I'm going to use that for a long time. I'm going to get around. You're going to see me popping up in my correspondences and letters and whatever all over the place. And you're going to wonder how a guy who's that busted is going to be able to make it around all these places. And that's the secret. I was a big guy, about 6'4", big boned, broad shoulders, big hefty, booming voice. Like I told you, I always kept that New England accent, never lost it. Steel blue eyes, and I used them. They were penetrating. I like to look down at you over the top of my glasses, you know. Work like a champ. I knew how to play. Very muscular hands. Everybody always wondered about that. Here I was, a surgeon. Big, giant, fat, muscular hands who were shaking all of the time, you know. You will never, ever see a picture of me in short-sleeve shirts. I will always have a coat on or a sweater, long-sleeve shirt or something. The reason for that was, starting up here, I had a compass tattooed on my arm. Had all 32 points of the compass embroidered in there. Matter of fact, Smitty and Sue learned navigation and directions and stuff using that compass. And then the dragon started up here. Blue, red, black, and it was mean and ugly and wound around here and came out down there and breathing fire. I wasn't really too proud of it. My son Smitty one time asked me, where in the world did I get that thing? And I just told him, well, that was a hell of a night. I never really admitted to where that occurred and how it came to be. I will tell you now that I'm an intellectual. You betcha. I was AA's first intellectual. I mean, in addition to being a doctor and an MD and all that, I loved philosophy. I ate up religion, for instance. My drive, the life of Jesus and how to pray were top. When I died, the kids said they were scared. They didn't know what to do. The house was full of books. I had books stacked on top of books so I could have a place to put my books. the end of the bed fell down and the leg broke off, and I put books under there. I had books on the nightstand. I had books there. I loaned out books to get rid of books, and I still had books. I read voraciously anything I could get my hands on. I read Latin and Greek. The guys that come in there and sell their medical instruments and tools to me, and a lot of that stuff's made in Germany, and I'd speak to them in German. I understood that certain depths could not be gained and understood unless you tried real hard to understand them. I read the Bible completely all the way through several times. Smitty, my boy, says that I had books with titles he couldn't even pronounce. And that is true. I think I'll tell you now that I do wish there was some, if I had to go back all over and do again, I wish there was something I could change. I wish I could go back and take back that statement. I wish I never said that statement, keep it simple. It's been abused by unlettered ignoramuses. They use it as an excuse to stay lazy, to insult others, and to maintain their little cliques. It's anti-intellectual, and it's not even possible. In addition to all that, it's not even what I said. I would appreciate it if folks could go back and finish reading the rest of that sentence. There isn't a period after keep it simple. The point of the whole thing was, and what I wish I really would have just said, was let's keep the Freudian complexes out of it. I wanted to tell you that psychoanalysis isn't going to fix alcoholics. It's a spiritual solution. That's the simplicity of the thing. You find God, and He fixes your problem. It's been abused. There's not much I can do about it now. It's too late to fix. I'm kind of a mixed bag of tricks. I'm like most human beings. I'm a little bit of everything. I'm full of fun. I have a lively, dry sense of humor. I said that about my dad, and amazingly enough, my son said it about me. I'm very irreverent towards authority, and I'm intolerant of ignorance. I keep it short, sweet, and to the point. Even my letters, if you get start looking through them, there's not too many of them. Very big letters, and they're one-pagers. I like slang. Whenever I'd be talking about preachers, I'd call them sky pilots. Whenever I got talking about my patients, they were frails. We're talking about going out and eating, I'd say, you put on the nose bag, and I called the nurses sugar. Well, the ones that I knew real well, you know, the important ones in powerful positions that I needed to butter up, the rest of them, I... When I went over to see Bill Wilson that night, I said, I don't want to talk to this mug. Make it snappy. I know they threw around that word Alcoholics Anonymous a lot back in those days, but I called them UDs, unknown drunks. Some of them we couldn't get to jail. We tried to oxidize them, but it didn't work. I'm the guy that invented the term pigeon. See, we'd knock them out with this paraldehyde stuff, and they'd stay out for 24, 36 hours at a crack. And I loved to watch them when they started coming to. Their eyeballs worked independently of each other. You ever seen a pigeon? Yeah. This one eye'd be over here looking for a drink, and this other eye'd be over here looking for the door to get out of here. They were what? That's where I called them pigeons. Oftentimes later on, I would be called one of the founders of Alcoholics, and I'd say, no, not me. I just work here. I like dirty jokes. I'll have to admit to that. Love dirty jokes. But not the off-colored brand. A good dirty joke. I love puns. I could do them by the hours. Smitty tells a story where we would just get, and he does too, we'd just get going and going, and I'd be laughing so hard, tears be coming down my eyes, I'd take off my glasses and wipe it. I love puns, and I gave everybody a nickname. Sister Ignatia, she was Iggy. Bill W., I call him Willie. There was one of those early guys, and his story winds up in a big book. Lloyd Tate was his name, and I called him Hezzy. Hezzy Tate, you know. Sometimes I was very, very blunt, particularly when I didn't like what was going on. I remember one time an intern in the hospital was prepping up for some rectal surgery there. And I never really believed there was a need to sterilize that area prior to surgery. And he was in there with all of the wipes and everything, and he had his forceps out there, and he was pulling the hairs out one at a time. You know, kind of like petals on a flower. She loves me, she loves me not, you know. I just looked over there and told him to stop it. And he said, why? And I said, how'd you like somebody pulling hairs out of your ass? The last 17 years of my drinking took its toll. I got morning cravings. As a matter of fact, I'd have to drink an iced tea tumbler of scotch in the morning just to get motivated. One morning it was so bad, I remember Sue came in and she was trying to wake me up, and I offered her 50 cents if she'd go out to the car. I had a bottle stashed out there in the car and get it for me so I could just get out of bed. She said no. I offered her $1. She said no. I said $5. She said no. I said $10, and she still said no. You got to remember the time period we're talking about. $10 back in those days was 2 weeks' wages. She said it was that morning that she realized how important booze was to me. I got into daily drinking. I never scheduled an operation before 11 o'clock because I knew better than to walk in there and try and perform surgery. I did take sedatives all day long till about 4 o'clock. I wasn't really addicted to them, I don't think. It was just a way to get me through the hospital until I could get home. And that's when the drinking started, because I didn't use them for any other purpose. I'd take a couple of shots, good 6-ounce shots of whiskey, just before I do a surgery. Those shakes, I could settle them down just a little bit with that whiskey. Now, I know in the big book on page 176, it says I never went to that. It's my story, and I wrote it. I never went to the hospital drinking, but I'd have to really think back and tell you that's not entirely accurate, because I'd take them shots of whiskey I was telling you about. And I tried not to let people around the hospital know I had that problem. Matter of fact, once I finally admitted to everybody I had this drinking problem, there were an awful, most of the doctors on that staff were totally amazed. Didn't have any idea whatsoever. Although I guess I'm like most drunks, I didn't entirely fool everybody. I thought I was getting away with it better than what I was, because I remember we went down to work over this Bill Dotson guy, this third guy. Bill and I got together and decided to work him over, and I went down to the night nurse and asked her if she had a prospect for us, you know. And she said, yes, yes, we do. A prospect for what? He said, well, we're going to try and get him over drinking with it. We got this cure for not drinking. And she looked up at me, and all the sincerity, she got me. She said, have you tried this on yourself yet? So, few people knew what was going on. These sedatives were to calm my shakes. You got to realize how bad they really, really were. And they worked. We're not talking about heavy-duty narcotics here. It was so I could function. I didn't take them all. Yeah, I took large doses, but for those shakes. I didn't use it to escape or for many of my problems or whatever. I had terrible insomnia. I couldn't, there's nights, several in a row, I couldn't even get to sleep all night long. But I didn't take sedatives for that. I didn't use them as cure-alls. They were just for the shakes. And when I quit drinking, I didn't have any problems quitting the drugs. There weren't any withdrawal. You'll never find any stories about me having withdrawal problems in the drugs and stuff. I know it's popular today. A lot of people say I was our first duly addicted. But I just would have to think, I don't think I was. I did write illegal prescriptions. But that was for booze, remember. So I think there might be a little abuse there of the true nature.